This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
A guy in a Parisian laboratory opens up your sample, you know, Jean-Francois so-and-so.
Lance Armstrong, winner of the Tour de France for the past 7 years, speaking on CNN's Larry King Live on Thursday night.
And he tests it. Nobody's there to observe. No protocol was followed. And then you get a phone call from a newspaper that says, we found you to be positive 6 times for EPO. Well, since when did newspapers start governing sports?
Armstrong had a number of objections to the urine testing that was publicized earlier in the week by the French sports newspaper L'Equipe. The samples in question had been collected during the 1999 tour and frozen. The stated purpose of the test was not to catch riders who might have cheated 6 years ago, but to test the efficacy of a relatively new procedure for detecting the presence of the banned red blood cell-boosting substance known as EPO. According to the World Doping Agency and the Paris laboratory where the testing occurred, the samples should have been anonymous. No one working in the lab and no journalist should have been able to connect them to Armstrong. Beyond that, Armstrong, perhaps the most often tested cyclist in the history of the sport, says he should have been informed of any further testing, and he was not. Armstrong also pointed out that since the A samples of his urine had been tested in 1999 and no longer existed, he has no way to appeal the results of this week's tests on his 6-year-old B samples. Since the purpose of EPO is to increase the red blood cell count, John Wilcoxon, the author of a book about Armstrong entitled 23 Days in July, finds the lab report dubious.
He had just recovered from cancer. He knew that drugs are very bad for your health, and he had no need to use them. Nowadays, and Lance included, and nearly every top athlete, endurance athlete, they use an altitude tent. They don't use EPO. An altitude tent means you're getting the equivalent of sleeping at altitude, which does increase your blood count.
Though L'Equipe is a reputable sports newspaper, it may not be an unbiased source as far as the latest Lance Armstrong story is concerned. Associated Press sports columnist Jim Litke feels the paper's coverage of Armstrong has been skeptical at best.
The Amari sports organization owns both L'Equipe and the Tour de France and essentially runs them out of the same building. And the newspaper, interestingly to me, I was there for the race as well, and the day after, their parting gift to Lance Armstrong was a quote to the effect, "Never has the retirement of a great champion been greeted with such widespread relief."
Sentiments like that would seem to lend credibility to Armstrong's contention that he has been the victim of a witch hunt, in which this week's allegations are only the most recent attacks. And Jim Litke maintains that there are further reasons to suspect the test results L'Equipe has reported.
I don't doubt that these were indeed Armstrong samples. I don't doubt that the newspaper was able to correlate the numbers. But I've heard from a number of scientists, including Dr. Christian Ayat at the WADA, it's the World Anti-Doping Agency lab just outside Montreal, where WADA is headquartered, question whether the samples could have been stored for that length of time successfully because EPO is a protein which tends to disintegrate over time.
Litke, like most of the journalists who have covered the exceptional exploits of Lance Armstrong over the past 7 years, has been thoroughly impressed by Armstrong's conditioning, his training regimen, and his will to win. He is reluctant to assume the worst about the 7-time tour winner, but he is also aware of the unavoidable context that has bred the suspicion Armstrong has battled for years.
Everything else about him to me screams champion. Every absolute thing else about him tells me that this is one of the greatest athletes of all time. The balancing side of that argument is cycling has been dirty since its inception. I'm convinced that some portion of it remains dirty today. It seems almost incongruous that the man who's dominated the last 7 years would be entirely clean.
That last contention is shared by David Walsh, a sports writer for the Sunday Times of London, who also co-authored a book entitled L.A. Confidential, The Secrets of Lance Armstrong. Mr. Walsh, who is being sued by Lance Armstrong for libel for material in the book, spoke to me by phone on Thursday. Since 6 samples that had not come from Lance Armstrong also tested positive for EPO this week, I asked Mr. Walsh why none of the other athletes with positive results had been identified.
I think those names will come out in the next few days. The word was that they didn't want the other names coming out because they wanted the focus to be on Armstrong. I mean, the other guys none of them were winners at the Tour de France, because obviously Lance has won the last seven. I mean, he has become such a monumental figure in the sport. I mean, he was the guy in 1999 when the Tour de France was called the Tour of Renewal after the huge drug scandal of 1998. Lance was the guy who was held up as a symbol of a new and better form of cycling. We were now told that the cyclists were doing it without doping. And here was Lance Armstrong, back from, you know, appalling cancer and magnificent recovery from a very serious illness. Here he was, back in his chosen sport, achieving unbelievable prowess in the Tour de France. And any journalist who was operating at that time had to be sceptical, because cycling had deceived us for so long. And there has been, I mean, there is a huge volume of evidence out there. Some of it circumstantial, much of it direct evidence, but this has gone further than any newspaper or media outlet has ever gone before.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because your co-author was L'Équipe reporter. L'Équipe and the Tour are owned, as I understand it, by the same parent company. This has led to charges that the newspaper and those who run the Tour are kind of in league against Lance Armstrong.
Oh, well, I wouldn't agree with that at all. Pierre Ballester, you're absolutely right. He did work with L'Équipe. He was a very fine cycling writer for them. And when Pierre saw what happened in 1999, the organizer of the Tour told us 2 months before the Tour, you will notice, because we have less dope this year, the speeds will go down. So please be patient with us. The riders can't ride as fast if they're not using all these blood-boosting products. What happened in 1999? The fastest Tour in the history of the Tour de France. So people like Pierre and I were saying, hold on here. So we started asking questions, and basically he got into trouble with L'Équipe, because, as you say, L'Équipe is part of the Armoury Group. They have a vested interest in promoting the Tour de France. Despite the fact that they've produced a quite brilliant story this week, L'Équipe hasn't been to the forefront of exposing drug scandals in the Tour de France. It has done its job journalistically, but it has also promoted its race in a way that suits its commercial interests.
Let me ask you a question which may be naive, but given that only the B samples remained for Lance Armstrong and there is no A sample, no other sample to test these positives against, why was it even possible to identify whose urine was being tested 6 years later? Why was that information even still around for a reporter to discover? Because prosecution wasn't going to happen.
Well, consider, Bill, that we have been told by members of the public, by people who are officials in sport, pretty much by everybody, we have been told you've got to beat this doping scourge in sport. You've got to use every legitimate means possible. And if that means you freeze samples and you analyze them 10, 15, even 20 years later because you've got new tests, and expose the guys who cheated, even if their cheating is 10 years old. When DNA came along, we had lots of people who were convicted on murder charges who had previously got away. And everybody thought, that's great. In the case of doping in sport, people have been telling us for years we should be freezing the samples and reanalyzing them when we've got better testing methods. And in a way, unwittingly, this is what has happened here. And I don't see how anybody wouldn't consider this a good thing.
The six tests to which you're referring, does this mean that on six separate occasions Lance Armstrong's urine was tested, and that's what we're talking about here? 6 days,
yeah,
six stages?
Yes, he was tested in all. He would have been tested, I'd say, somewhere between 15 and 18 times on that Tour de France. Six of them were positive. Now, L'Équipe, in their investigation, have looked at the actual dates in which the EPO was in his urine sample. And coincidentally, they were all on days which would be regarded as the defining days in the Tour de France, as the days on which the race was decided and Lance made his big moves. That's circumstantial evidence, of course, that he was using EPO at particular times, but that certainly, to any cycling aficionado, that would make perfect sense. You know, if you're leading the race by 8 minutes and there's two flat stages left, they actually can be, relatively speaking, easy. And on a day like that, you may not do things that you would do on another day.
So if you're right, this isn't a question of using EPO in preparation for the Tour de France. It's a matter of using it throughout.
Absolutely. But I don't think anybody. I think even when the EPO test came in, I don't think riders in the Tour de France, and we're not talking about one rider here, we're talking about quite a number of riders in the Tour de France. I don't think they stopped using EPO. I certainly don't think they stopped using blood-boosting techniques. This year's Tour de France was another record speed. The speed keeps going up year on year. And I think the feeling in the peloton now, it's the old-fashioned blood doping, if you like. They're having their blood taken out maybe a month, 6 weeks before the Tour. It's being stored at the right temperature. And then it's brought back at particular points in the Tour when the riders need an injection of red cells. And that's been happening in recent years as the test for EPO has been more and more refined.
David, you are being sued by Armstrong for material in your book. Does this week's news make you feel vindicated?
Not really. I mean, I couldn't say it's bad news, to be honest. But it doesn't vindicate me. And I don't see it like that. All I've done as a journalist is gone out there and tried to find the truth. I mean, I've written about Marion Jones. I've written about Ben Johnson. I'm an Irish person. I came back from the 1996 Olympics at Atlanta. And I said, you mustn't believe Michelle Smith, our triple gold medalist in the swimming pool. I said, everything is pointing to the fact that this woman dopes. And the point I would make is that you can't do this if you don't believe 100% that what you're doing is right. And I've believed from day one about Lance Armstrong that what I was doing was right. I don't know if you know, but there's a book, and it's on sale in the US, called Armstrong's War, written by a very fine journalist called Dan Coyle. And I'm in that book in an almost pervasive way. And I won't use the word, but Lance Armstrong in this book calls me, and I almost hate to say it even in the first I'm going to say, he called me an effing scumbag. He called me a little effing troll. Now, I would never say anything like that about Lance Armstrong because I don't consider him in that way at all. But when you're an icon, you can say things about people and everybody thinks it's fine. I think people in the US are going to have to look very closely at Lance and ask a lot of questions that so far it hasn't been popular to ask in the US. America is the country that gave us Woodward and Bernstein and Watergate. Now, so has all that died?
Journalist David Walsh is the co-author of L.A. Confidential, The Secrets of Lance Armstrong. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the Dodgers go back to the land of childhood. But first, there is a school of thought that regards sports as pure escape, an entertainment refuge for people who are either tired of or have no interest in politics or social issues. In a new book entitled What's My Name, Fool?, Dave Zirin argues the contrary. He says he loves sports, but he also loves finding in our games springboards for his opinions about how those games are corrupted, how the men who own the teams gouge the public, and how the players themselves are used or use us. Dave Zirin joins me now from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Dave, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, it's great to be here, Bill.
It had never occurred to me before reading your book that in other countries they don't play the national anthem before games begin. How did that custom linking sports and nationalism become so entrenched here?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the national anthem. It's having scantily clad women tell us when and when not to cheer. It's calling our national champions world champions. I mean, you go to other parts of the world and they do look at our sport and culture more than a little quizzically. But when you're talking about nationalism, I mean, that really goes back to the roots of when sports took off as kind of an organized pastime in the United States. I mean, there's always been sports in the United States, from Native Americans before Europeans even got here, to games played by working people in urban centers, to slaves on plantations. There's always been sports, competition. But when it was first sort of segmented off and turned into something that was separated from people's day-to-day lives in terms of leagues and a sports page, it was tied even from those early days into something that had to do with instilling what was called the American character or preparing people for the American century. Like if you look at some of the early philosophizers of organized sports, philosophers, I should say, that being a word, you look at people like Teddy Roosevelt, or if you look at some of the financial backers of it, like J.P. Morgan, I mean, it was very conscious with them that it wasn't just, hey, it would be really fun to get some bats and some balls and go out and play some games. No, it was very conscious, like, this is how we will harden up our men of leisure.
And numbers of leaders said this is the way to prepare young men for war.
Yes, and that's an exact quote by a former five-star general people might have heard of named Dwight David Eisenhower. That's what he said. It is about preparing young men for war. And I think that there's always been that aspect to sports, because I think sports in whatever culture you're talking about, Native American, the serfs, in Russia, or this society here, it's always been a reflection of that society. And certainly, the U.S. is engaged in, a couple of wars over the last 100 years, and I think the sporting culture definitely reflects that.
Some of the sports figures whom you identify as representative of resistance do not maintain that distinction over time. Talk a little bit about the various ways in which the country's relationship with Muhammad Ali has changed over the years.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it starts by understanding how Muhammad Ali's changed his own stance towards the country, if you want to do the full arc of it, and then how the country then reacted to him. I mean, Muhammad Ali at age 17 made the Olympic team. At age 18, he won an Olympic gold medal in Rome in 1960. And when he returned to the States, it's amazing what he said. He came back and went up to the microphone and said, "To make America the greatest is my goal, so I beat a Russian and I beat a Pole, and for the USA I won the medal of gold, and the Greeks said, you're better than the Cassius of old." So back then, he's like, basically the Gorgeous George of boxing, and a few years later, this will be a guy who'd be saying, "To hell with America, you can keep the white man's money, this is one man you couldn't get." And so you can't understand that transformation without understanding the 1960s and the black freedom struggle and the anti-war movement and how that shaped Ali, and then how Ali in turn then shaped those movements themselves. And that's one of the things that was such a thrill to uncover with the book, is that level of interaction, which you don't really hear about in Sports Century or, ESPN Presents Muhammad Ali, like that level of radical edge to his life and to his politics over the course of the 1960s. It's really quite remarkable. Now, mainstream culture at the time, the media and whatnot, they absolutely despised Ali. I mean, first for changing his name, then thumbing his nose at the armed forces. But at the same time, you had a whole generation of young activists, like on college campuses, in the U.S. South, registering black voters, that were just positively electrified by this. So you had this Ali who symbolized the split in the country at the time. And whether you called him Clay or Ali, it said everything about you in terms of what side you were on in the struggles of the day.
One of the activists whom you celebrate in your book is Eddie Mustafa Muhammad, a former world champion light heavyweight who's been trying to establish a union for boxers that would provide them with medical care and pensions.
Yes.
What are the chances that he will succeed?
That's a terrific question, because on the one hand, boxing is one of the most utterly corrupt, decentralized, scurrilous businesses, not only sports, but businesses in the country. I mean, that's one of the reasons I think why it's hard to imagine an Ali today is back when Ali was around, boxing was in some respects the number one sport in the United States. Yet today, it's almost a carnival sideshow, given its just utter disorganization and corruption. But at the same time, where are boxing's absolute centers of power still are Las Vegas and Atlantic City, two very strong union strongholds. And Eddie Mustafa Muhammad has said, if we don't get what we're demanding for, you're going to see some boxers sit down like right in the Bellagio lounge and see what happens then. And that's an amazing thing, because I think Don King would start ponying up the dough mighty quick if Arturo Gatti decided to have a seat on top of one of the slot machines in the Bellagio.
All right. From your point of view, who are the most villainous characters in the current sports scene?
I mean, as far as people today, I mean, I would hate to say, because I wouldn't want to express my own regional bias, but certainly I have to say I think the motley crew of owners in the National Football League and their ability to really exploit the death of Pat Tillman was something that, to me, is something I can't even look at comically. I mean, just something that I thought was above and beyond the pale.
Speaking of regions, you're not a great fan of the name of the National Football League team in your region, I gather.
Yeah, and that is one of my less popular local stances, I got to tell you. Not a fan of the name Washington Redskins. Want to see the name changed. Even at the newspaper I work at, the Prince George's Post, we held a contest to change the name, which, you know, earned me some nicknames that I can't really say over the air.
Well, give me some that you can, because that's a potentially interesting contest.
Sure. No, it was. I'll tell you the good ones then. I mean, because, I mean, I think the Redskins is a name that belongs in the dustbin of history, along with the burning of witches. I think it's just insane that there's a pro football team with this name, and it was named by a segregationist named George Preston Marshall as a way to market the team to the South. This is all historical fact. And so, you know, in Prince George's County where I work, it's 70%, 80% African-American. So I put out there, what do we want to name the team that actually reflects our area? Because unless we want gutter racism to reflect our area. And some of the answers we got were great. Like one was the Washington Dukes after one of our favorite native son, Duke Ellington.
Mm-hmm.
Another was actually the Washington Gays after another favorite native son, Marvin Gaye. But I think I'm serious. But I was saying that I don't quite
know. No controversy there.
Yeah, I don't know if we're quite there yet. I'll settle for going for Dukes, you know. The Washington Gays might be a little beyond where the collective sports consciousness is here locally. And then the one that I really liked the most at the end of the day was the Washington Snyders. Named after Dan Snyder, the owner of the team. I mean, it was done a little bit sarcastically, tongue-in-cheek, because people joked about what the mascot could look like a pudgy, obnoxious, surly gentleman who could look at everybody and go, "What are you looking at?" You know, and then charge people $10 for breathing his air. Love the mascot idea, but the name isn't too catchy.
Your writing suggests that you admire Barry Bonds enormously. Why is that?
My admiration for Barry Bonds, I mean, it starts, honestly, it's got like two prongs in some respect that exist apart from each other. One is I feel like he is the only baseball player in my lifetime, with the exception of maybe Dwight Gooden in his rookie year, who I feel like, I mean, actually stands above the game of baseball in terms of his skills. I mean, baseball is an almost impossible sport to dominate on an individual basis because of the nature of the game. And Barry Bonds dominates the sport in a way that's incredible. Now, on another level, I admire him tremendously. Honestly, because I feel like I admire him the same reason why I admire Sean Penn. I mean, it's like, yeah, they both have tremendous ability in their craft, but I like the fact that Sean Penn will tell you to go to hell and then tell you why, even if I don't always agree with him and even if he's not always right. Like, he's actually a human being. And I feel that way about Barry Bonds. Like, he's almost, he's just in this incredibly human figure. Players are most interesting when they're human, you know, not when they're giants, not when they're heroes. And the like. And I think Barry Bonds is just an achingly human figure. And I think there's a case for reasonable doubt on the question of steroids, which I talk about in the book.
You write that, quote, "by speaking out for the political soul of the games we love, we begin to compete with the yawning hypocrisy of the pro leagues." What sort of hypocrisy do you have in mind when you say that?
The yawning hypocrisy of the pro leagues. I mean, to me, the hypocrisy of the pro leagues has to do with, I'll give you just some examples, like the way that a lot of the NFL and hockey in particular, the video games that the leagues market, trade on some like absolutely repellent violence. But at the same time, it's like, and also they do all the raunchy touchdown dances. And this is like the majority of young sports fans, they all play these games. Another is, I think, the issue of sexism is just a horrible hypocrisy in sports, where there's, you know, I mean, certainly there's talk about, like, with the WNBA and women's soccer, this idea of promoting women's sports. But at the same time, it's like you've got the Coors Light twins and, you know, the cheerleaders and teams like just market sexism relentlessly to sell their games. And you know, it piles on itself. And piles on itself to the point where I know a lot, and certainly the number one area is the area of commercialization in sports. And the idea that you can't go 5 seconds in a stadium without feeling like someone's either selling you something, you're looking at an ad, and it can become just overbearing. And I mentioned Daniel Snyder before, owner of the Washington Redskins. I mean, you can't get free parking near the stadium anymore. You actually have to buy a Redskins credit card to get quote-unquote discounts on merchandise, when actually all he did was raise the prices on everything else. I mean, so it really is, I mean, to a lot of people, it's become this point of where people are so alienated from these games that they love. And that is, I don't like. And a lot of times, sometimes I've been called like sort of like a radical sports writer or whatever. But I honestly feel like that I'm a traditionalist and Daniel Snyder is the radical. Because I want sports a la carte, you know? That's what I want. I grew up playing sports. I want to be able to go to the game and just enjoy it. And but the reason why I feel like I even had to write a book about the radical tradition in sports was because sports, like the other side of it, the right-wing politics, reactionary politics, commercialism, are so relentlessly hustled through sports that it demands a response.
Dave Zirin writes a column called The Edge of Sports for the Prince George's Post and comments on sports for So What Else Is News on Air America. His book, What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States, is published by Haymarket Books. He spoke with me from NPR in Washington. Dave, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it's my privilege.
You played the game at recess as a child, and you may have seen the movie last summer. Now you can play dodgeball as an adult without fear of ridicule, and perhaps even go pro, Minnesota Public Radio's Tony Randolph reports.
You remember dodgeball, don't you? You may have played the game in gym class back in elementary or middle school. Dodgeball is banned in many school districts around the country now because it's considered violent and bad for children's self-esteem. But what's bad for the kid is sometimes good for the adult. Just ask the people at the Dodgett Dodgeball Center in Minneapolis.
Personally, I have been playing it since fourth grade, loved it back then. So I thought, let's do this, give it a shot, see what it's like. And one season turned into two, turned into three, and now we're in our fifth.
I think it's kind of reliving your childhood a bit. I mean, it's like when you were kids, you were playing dodgeball. You're here to be with your friends, having fun. I think as we're older now, most of us are in our 20s. Here we are, still playing with our friends. You know, it's just that we're just 20 years older.
The Dodgett Center in the Uptown neighborhood in Minneapolis has dedicated dodgeball courts. They're in a converted warehouse where 20 and 30-somethings play, including Troy Lanoux. He says the leagues are highly organized, but the rules are pretty simple.
You throw balls at each other. If you get hit by a ball, you're out. If you catch a ball, somebody gets in. The person who throws it out is out. Gosh, that's the real basics.
Rachel Howells, who plays with her boyfriend on a co-ed team, says dodgeball skills are as basic as the rules.
You have to be able to throw, you have to be able to catch, or you have to be able to dodge. And if you can't throw or catch, you'd better have a pretty good survival instinct.
For those who don't like organized activities, have no fear, pickup dodgeball is here. Every Saturday afternoon, rain or shine, you can find a game at Kenwood Park in Minneapolis. In a meadow near the tennis courts, there's a makeshift court bounded by bright orange cones and a tall chain-link fence. On a rainy and cool Saturday in May, about eight people showed up. A small crowd compared to the dozens who attend on nicer days, but the enthusiasm of this group wasn't dampened. You can find Troy Lanoux here, too. He says there's a big difference between the dodgeball played here and the version favored at the Dodgett Center.
Well, there's still competitiveness between people, I think. There's people that play regularly, and but there's more, I think, camaraderie and just appreciation that we're all here to have fun. And it's not about winning or losing. It's just about kind of, you know, being outside and playing dodgeball.
Many people who are drawn to the outdoor games cite the dodgeball movie for renewing their interest. It's about a bunch of misfits who enter a dodgeball tournament to save their gym. The dodgeball movie generated so much interest that it sparked a cable TV game show, and now there are plans for a professional league. Ed Prentice is the president of the newly formed National Dodgeball League, which will include amateurs and professionals.
We're looking for really good athletes that are going to play this sport at the top level. It's not meant to be a sideshow. It's not meant to be goofy. It's not meant to be quirky. And that's a battle that we'll face because when you mention dodgeball, people go, are you kidding me?
Prentice wants to launch the professional league in the fall with four teams based in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Texas, and New York. Tryouts will be held in September when the National Dodgeball League sponsors its first amateur world championship in Las Vegas. And Prentice says he's only looking for the best.
When we go out to Vegas, we're not looking for anybody. If they can't play, then they can't play.
For Only a Game, I'm Tony Randolph in Minneapolis.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, colleges attempt to net netsters who wish to be netted. What a racket. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a conversation about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
I hesitate to ask, but are you ready for some football?
Hold it.
Ah, the Heisman pose.
There we go.
We are officially underway.
Of course I am. I'm not ready for 11 games on Thursday night, though. I have to admit that.
11 college games.
Including such traditional rivals as Minnesota at Tulsa and Oregon at Houston.
Also, William and Mary at Marshall.
Well, that's at least a bus ride.
Well, what about this? The incredible expanding phenomenon of college football. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and then the printer ran out. But
I presume it goes on. See, I tell you, Bill, when you don't have the NFL, this is what happens. You get 5 days of college football. The only game that's really worth watching anytime the next 2 weeks is Texas going to play at Ohio State the second weekend of the season. I'll bet you didn't know. This is the first time those two teams have ever played.
It's one of the many things about college football that I was
like one of those games that should have been in the wartime Rose Bowl or
something, but
they've never played.
Charlie, we have lamented the lack of good college bowl names.
And remember, the bowl season starts 2 weeks from Thursday.
Absolutely, since the demise of the Poulon Weed Eater Bowl. But the 2005-2006 college bowl schedule is out. And I will assume that you're happy to see that some great new names have emerged.
I think the Pioneer Pure Vision Las Vegas Bowl is a terrific name. Pure Vision Las Vegas leads us to all sorts of things. But I know your favorite is the Poinsettia Bowl presented by San Diego County Credit Union. Remember when they only used to give you a calendar?
What do they call that one for short?
If you open an account, a Christmas club with these people, you can referee this game.
I love it. The threat of litigation has once again proved to be a popular strategy in matters sports-related. Florida State threw some letters from lawyers at the NCAA, and the result was...
If the Florida State Seminoles are, by some strange thing, playing in the Poinsettia Bowl presented by San Diego County Credit Union, the Seminole will be there in the teller line with them, waiting to open his account. Yeah, the NCAA backed and filled on this one, trying to avoid a lawsuit. And it recognized the, quote, relationship Florida State has long enjoyed with the Seminole Tribe of Florida, which assists the university with its pageantry and celebration of its culture and supports the school's use of its name. So get rid of the lawyers, will you?
Bob Huggins is now an ex-men's basketball coach at the University of Cincinnati. He was given an ultimatum early this week to resign or be fired. Was his decision to resign on Wednesday a brave one?
I think it was a smart one, because I think there are all sorts of contractual ramifications that are avoided when you retire and you're not fired. It's ugly out there. It's a woman president firing a hyper-macho, successful men's basketball coach who spent his entire career with a zero graduation rate and enabling various thugs and hoodlums. That's never a good scene in the wide world of big-time college sports.
Speaking of choices, who do you like as coach of the Miami Heat in the 2005-2006 NBA season?
Well, I like Stan Van Gundy in 2005 and Pat Riley in 2006. Apparently, the news from down there is if somehow Stan Van Gundy, who's done nothing down there except win games and develop Dwayne Wade into a great player and keep Shaq happy, if he doesn't start, 28-1, the substitute genius in the front office is going to step in and coach the team.
Charlie, I'm on the record as a Dwight Gooden fan. I loved it when he rehabbed and then threw a no-hitter at the tail end of what should have been an even more brilliant career than it was, but these days he really seems to be his own worst enemy.
Yeah, he was stopped for DWI. He fled the scene. He had to turn himself in. He was arrested last March for hitting his living girlfriend in the face. It's not going to end well. But as you say, for six glorious months, he was just a terrific story, and he was a great story when he came back, but apparently this is headed to no good end.
The director of the Tour de France was quoted this week as saying that it was a proven fact that Lance Armstrong had used an illegal performance-enhancing substance. I gather there are others who regard the fact to which Jean-Marie LeBlanc referred as an unproven fact.
Well, I mean, for those folks who are enamored of the culture of drug testing must love this story, because you're dealing with aging samples. You're dealing with not a steroid, but a red blood cell booster. Lance Armstrong has denied it. There is no compelling reason not to believe him. At the same time, this isn't a renegade French tabloid making these charges. This is L'Équipe, which is a very, very respected newspaper. I don't believe is going to go away. This one they seem very sure of. Lance Armstrong has said he's not going to sue because he doesn't want to keep the story alive. Lots of luck there. But when you have a culture of suspicion, and it's not a culture of suspicion just because people may or may not have used the drugs, it's a culture of suspicion because it sells newspapers and gets you on TV, this is what you get.
Washington Nationals manager Frank Robinson and Boston Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling have in common the belief that Rafael Palmeiro should be disappeared, like one of those Russian generals who appears in a photo on the Kremlin wall until he falls from favor. What do you think?
It's silly. You're going to knock out the guy's record. You don't know how much he's done. You don't know when. Curt Schilling should be quiet and work on his split-finger fastball, which is hanging up in the strike zone too much, and stop being Attorney General and Secretary of State for a while. Frank Robinson is just a wonderful old figure. I just think he's wrong on this.
So you're not one of those guys, though, who believes that Curt Schilling's record should be erased because he couldn't beat the Royals the other night.
No. I think that's a sin we can all forgive.
Elsewhere in Major League Baseball, we have a 6-game suspension. And the crime provoking it is so heinous that Major League Baseball doesn't choose to name the miscreant. What's going on here?
A bat boy apparently took a dare from Brad Penny, who pitches for the Dodgers, used to pitch for the Marlins, that he could drink a gallon of milk in an hour without vomiting. I'm not exactly sure why the guy was suspended unless he threw up on Dontrell Willis.
Neither threw up nor finished the gallon of milk, apparently.
I guess it's a gambling thing, but yeah. Luckily the Milk Processor Education Program, or MPEP, among those of us fond of acronyms, is offering the kid $500, the original price plus any lost wages. So all's well that's end well. Although Penny does point out that it's ridiculous. You get a 10-game suspension for steroids and a 6-game suspension for milk.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
A gallon of milk? Ugh.
We traveled from Japan. It's a 13-hour flight to JFK, New York, and then we drove up yesterday. So we're quite jet-lagged.
At the Donovan Tennis Strategies College Prospects Showcase at the Yale University Courts in New Haven, Connecticut earlier this summer, Mimi Yoshi could only hope that her son, Takashi, was less jet-lagged than she and her husband were. Like the scores of other players on hand who just finished their junior year in high school, Takashi had arrived hoping that one or more of the 70 or so college coaches present for the 2-day event would see in him a prospect. Takashi has acknowledged to his parents that college would be a diminished experience if he doesn't make the tennis team. He has that in common with each racket-wielding young scholar at the showcase. But most of the parents on hand to watch their children play, and to watch the coaches watching them, were perhaps less ambitious for their offspring than Takashi's dad, Saki, who was Japan's junior champion in 1966.
We want him to qualify for the major Grand Slam, you know, tournaments. We would like to see him to be in there.
On this clear, sunny morning in New Haven, the rest of the players seem to be thinking in terms of college rather than the pros.
Katie, are you here?
Yes.
Casey?
On court one, to help those players make the best impression they could on college coaches who weren't attending the showcase, was Lance Luciani of Bradenton, Florida. He's made a career of videotaping tennis players so they can send tapes to the campuses of their choice. Each tape, which costs $395, includes close-ups, long shots of simulated points, and text screens with stats on past tournament triumphs. And, according to Mr. Luciani, nobody looks bad.
We do some editing. We show the kids in a positive note. I mean, there's no player that wants to be looked at, you know, in a negative note in something they're trying to impress a coach, yes, but it is realistic, you know, that they are seeing points and you can't fake that.
Realistically, nobody at the showcase had to fake anything. Tim Donovan, who started the tennis showcase 5 years ago, had 140 applicants for 88 spots in this summer's event. Only the strong even got the opportunity to shine.
We'll look at a player's ranking to make sure that they're capable of playing at this level and nobody's going to sort of embarrass themselves. We look also at geographic location. For these coaches, we'd like to provide a nice service for them as well. And if they can see players that they might not normally see, for instance, we have a player from Japan, we have a player from Hong Kong, a player from South Africa, they're not really going to get to see these players play anywhere else.
Donovan serves as a paid consultant to parents trying to find the college with the right combination of academics and tennis for their particular scholar-athletes or athlete-scholars. The showcase is an outgrowth of his work, though not all the players at the showcase are his clients. The program Tim Donovan handed out to the coaches as they arrived in New Haven provided not only a summary of each player's tennis accomplishments and his or her photograph, but information about high school class rank, grade point average, and SAT scores as well, thus enabling coaches from schools that are especially selective to bypass players they couldn't sneak past the admissions officers. On this morning, before the competition began, Donovan explained to everyone that the players had been divided into groups to provide a sort of round-robin system of matches.
We've named the teams after the top eight-ranked Division I college programs this year. So by team, I'm going to announce the players. I'd just like you to come out here. All right, we're going to start with the team that we're calling the Stanford Cardinal. Jamie Haar from Alpine, New Jersey.
The fantasy of playing for the Stanford Cardinal, Florida Gators, or Texas Longhorns for a day might be appealing, even for somebody who intends to go to Colby or Cornell. But I wondered if these kids, all of them tournament tested, could really get excited about 2 days of mini-matches that would have no bearing on their regional or national ranking. Tim Donovan assured me that nonchalance was not a problem.
Yeah, it's not a worry. I actually have to, in the player meeting, sort of calm them down. This is sort of the culmination of many years of hard work. And most players that play at this level aspire to play in college. And it can be a very nerve-wracking experience to play in front of a coach. So they are, I would bet that if you talk to most of them, they're giving more effort in this event than they ever would, you know, anywhere else.
For some of the players, the tension Tim Donovan invoked may have been a problem, but not for Allison Fick of Palm Beach, Florida, and Jacqueline Wong of West Windsor, New Jersey. They'd been paired for the doubles competition, and after they'd won their match, they walked off the court with their arms around each other, giggling like, well, teenagers.
Did you know each other before today?
No.
And here you are, arm in arm.
So this Everybody's is nice. My girl.
That's good. So this is like an added benefit to this, right? You play together.
You meet new people.
Okay. So who knows? Maybe you play tennis in college together.
Maybe.
That'd be awesome.
Several coaches have emailed Jacqueline Wong to indicate their interest. I asked both Wong and Allison Fick if the opportunity to see and be seen by dozens of coaches at the showcase had helped them to narrow their choices.
Well, it seems like everyone here is pretty nice, you know? Like, I like the atmosphere and the people. So if they're like that in college, that would be great.
Just hope all my teammates are like her.
Oh, Jackie.
On the bleacher beside the court, Jacqueline and Allison had just victoriously vacated, sat Tesh Manesh, who'd traveled to New Haven from Southern California. She, too, shrugged off the suggestion that the pressure would be on when she began playing.
It's fun for me. I mean, you're so focused on the court, you don't really see who's walking by. And you just put it out of your mind. If you see the coaches, you know, they're nice people. They're not intimidating or anything like that. So it's really not that much. It's really not that scary.
Well, maybe they're nice people to you because they want you to come to their school and play
tennis.
And
I have no problem with that.
All this happy talk notwithstanding, the 70 or so coaches wandering around the courts that day were on hand to work, or at least to begin to work. Some scribbled in notebooks, some studied the player profiles. Most of them maintained that getting a chance to see all these players in one place at the same time made a heck of a lot more sense than traipsing around the country to tournaments. and that Tim Donovan had collected some excellent players. But at least one coach was initially skeptical about the whole affair.
Philosophically, I'm not wild about the idea because it's a little bit of a quote-unquote meat market.
Sean Sloan is the men's coach at Haverford College in Pennsylvania. As a Division III school, Haverford does not have athletic scholarships, so Coach Sloan was not in New Haven trying to figure out what he should offer to whom, as some of the coaches from the Division I schools were. But when he checked the player profiles, he was pleasantly surprised by the stats that matter most to him.
I mean, Haverford's one of the top 10 small colleges in the country. And yet, I think almost at least three, maybe four out of every five kids here could possibly qualify for Haverford. That's an amazing proportion. So that's what drew me to come, even though philosophically I kind of don't like the idea.
A few courts over, Amy Smith, the women's coach at Emory University in Atlanta, had turned away from a match in progress. She says it doesn't take her long to tell if the player she's watching can play at the level she requires, but that, like Coach Sloan, she's got recruiting concerns at Emory that go beyond the player's serve, volley, and quick feet.
You got to be able to pay to go there. I don't have many athletic scholarships. Our financial aid is not all that it could be, so I got to find a kid who not only can pay to go there, but also can get in academically because it's a great academic institution, and that's our top priority. That's why we're Division III.
Cecily DeBusker, the assistant women's coach at Brown University, faces a similar challenge, which is a little ironic since DeBusker, who only graduated from college 3 years ago, attended Drake University in Iowa on a tennis scholarship. She still recalls one of the darker days of trying to get there.
If you play a bad match, chances are you're going to think that that's going to be the reason why you didn't go to a school. I remember playing really bad national clay courts and my dad being like, "We're never, you know, you're never going to get into a school, you're never going to find a place, we're doomed." And my father sort of like made it his lifelong goal that I was going to get a college tennis scholarship, so not only was my life like riding on it, but his passion was also.
Oh my goodness.
So I don't know if mine's a special case or not, but there's probably some families like mine.
On that sunny morning in New Haven, the parents I saw didn't appear to be desperate. None of the players to whom I spoke had broken out in nervous hives. Nobody was hyperventilating. Some of the coaches seemed to be spending as much time saying hello to their rival mentors as they were watching the players. But then it was only mid-June. Recruiting rules dictated that the coaches couldn't even speak to the players they were watching for another month. Now it's late August. Those kids who just finished their junior year are about to become seniors. Soon they'll begin choosing. A little later, some of them will be chosen. I hope they're all feeling quietly confident rather than doomed. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to be a virtual tennis camper, browse Only a Game show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Dave Zirin, author of What's My Name, Fool, who reveals that his family may have a future as book promoters.
When I wrote this book, the first thing they said to me was, "You got to be on this guy Bob's show."
Jack, it's been a real pleasure. Larry, I'm Biff Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.